Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All manner of persons having anything to bring before the Honorable Justices of the Supreme Court of the State of Delaware will now draw near and give their attendance. The court is now open. God save the state and the Honorable Court.
Good morning. Ready to begin?
Yes. May it please the court. First, I'd like to recognize that we did file amendments in this case and quite extensive appendices, and we do appreciate the court's relevance in reviewing that material and all the effort that goes into doing it. I think it's fair to say that this is one of the more important administrative law cases that this court is going to hear because it involves the level of judicial scrutiny that should be applied to a rulemaking. There is no definitive case law in Delaware that we're aware of that addresses that matter. I believe the central fact of this case is that the Denrec rule is ultimately based on California rule, the CARB rule, explained in brief, and that there is little doubt that that's the case. Mr. Pettigill, Denrec's chief architect of the rule, expressly stated that the rule was ultimately based on California rule. The answer in brief extensively discusses the CARB rationale, and there's also evidence to show that every disputed provision that we have with the Denrec rule is identical to the CARB rule. Now, the reliance on the California rule poses two very significant problems.
Mr. Hummer, before we get into that, can we talk about the standard of review?
Yes.
As you know, there appear to be competing theories here. One side advocates review under the Administrative Procedures Act, and the other looks at the Title VII. In this case, the Superior Court picked the Administrative Procedures Act basically because it was a subsequent enactment. And my question is that really the standard? Because it assumes that adopting the Administrative Procedure Act eliminated a lot of Title VII. And, you know, Title VII in 6008 specifically has a provision that says appeals of regulations. And then it goes on to talk about what the standard is going to be. And it goes on to say you can either go to the Environmental Appeals Board or by stipulation go directly to the Superior Court. And it talks about the standard of review. Now, what's your position with regard to whether Title VII survived the enactment of the Administrative Procedures Act or it's been eliminated by it?
As I understand the case law, the later enacted statute, doctrine, if you want to call it doctrine, applies where there's an inconsistency between an earlier statute and a later statute. In fact, the Superior Court's opinion cites a case to that effect in footnote. I think the question is whether or not the two statutes are inconsistent. I don't think they are. I think you can read them both. The overriding principle, whether you do it under an arbitrary and capricious standard, which is one standard set forth in Chapter 60, or you use the unreasonable basis standard in the ADA, still come around the same inquiry, I think, and that is, what does the court look at to determine under either standard?
I realize that when you preface your argument by saying this is the most important case of its type that we're going to be considering, it's going to be helpful to future litigants for us to pick one.
I think that's right.
Not saying no matter which one you pick, you're going to come out the same way.
It would be very helpful if the court clarified the interplay between those two statutes. There's no question about that. I tend to think they can be read consistently. But I do argue that in any event, there isn't enough record evidence for the court to find a Denrec standard in this case.
All right, so for purposes of our appeal, pick one. Which do you want us to review it under?
I think it should be reviewed under both standards.
No, you have to pick one.
I think it would be read consistently. I think you can look at Section 6009, which talks about fact-finding. The substantial evidence applies to fact-finding, and you can look at the APA to look at the bar question, whether there's a reasonable basis in the record for the conclusions.
Right, Right, well, in this opinion, my specific question is, are we going to say that we continue to review these type of regulations under Title VII and those specific provisions that say appeals of regulations?
I think you can. You can say that.
Thank you.
I was speaking about the heavy reliance on the CARB rule for this rule and the two problems that poses. The first problem is that Benrick hadn't produced the underlying evidence that supports the CARB rule. And an affirmance in this case would be a major departure from the mainstream administrative law. Because federal law is very clear, and this $1 case is very clear, that to justify rulemaking, the court scrutinizes the evidence and determines whether there's a basis for it or not. It's not up to the agency to recite some conclusory evaluation of what the evidence is, and the court rely on that. Obviously, if that were the standard, there would be the need for judicial review. Benrick could come in every time and say, we've reviewed all these CARB studies, and we've done peer review of all this, and we're satisfied. We like it. That's the word Mr. Pettigill used. We determined we liked it, and it was good work. The $1 case is the exclusive decision where the court rejected that kind of approach. Now, the injury brief talks about the exquisite detail in the CARB staffing report and how that lays out the basis for the rule, but the court hasn't seen that. The court hasn't been given that. EAB, the Environmental Appeals Board, wasn't given that. And again, the Fenric asking the court to rely on Mr. Pettigill's evaluation of the staff report rather than show you what's in the staff report that supports the rule. Now, at page 41 of the Environmental Appeals Board opinion, the board makes clear that that's what it's doing. It's relying on Mr. Pettigill and says, in fact, the very language, according to Mr. Pettigill, the CARB reports and surveys were peer reviewed, and he was satisfied that those reports were adequate to support the rule. The only evidence that is even mentioned is the Aberdeen Proving Ground study and the NTS study, but that evidence isn't put before the board, and hasn't been put before the court. In fact, I think there's some question as to whether the NTS study or some of these other studies, the Harlan study or the Peckman study, are even in the record. They weren't in the list of documents, the master list of documents. They haven't been submitted to the court. And
if we go back to the standard of review, I take it that these comments, this argument you're making, is to the effect that there's not a reasonable basis in the record to adopt the regulation.
That's right. Exactly right.
And
let me
interrupt for a minute.
No, it's not. What I just read from was Title VII. And the reason I'm staying with this standard of review just for a moment is because the way I read the Administrative Procedures Act, you would have gone directly to the court to attack the regulation, but that's not what you did here. You really did follow the procedure in Title VII by going to the Environmental Appeals Board.
That's right.
Well, let me follow up on Justice Holland's question, then get back to what I was concerned about. Is it your position that there are two different ways that somebody can attack a regulation, and depending upon which route you take, you get a different level of scrutiny?
No, I don't think that's the argument. I think no matter what the standard review is, the approach is to demonstrate there is a problem with regulation. That's the appellant's burden, and then it's up to the agency to show from the record evidence that there's a reasonable basis for it.
So, if you had chosen instead to go directly to Superior Court, you would be, as far as you're concerned, in exactly the same position in terms of the legal standards that would be applicable?
The legal standard, I think, yeah, would be given to the APA. The APA does talk about reasonable basis. There are two difficulties in going directly, I think, to court. One is there is a requirement in Chapter 7 that suggests can't do that. You have to exhaust the administrative remedy of going to the Environmental Appeals Board first, unless the parties agree otherwise. And secondly, you don't really have much of a record because there's been no hearing before Benner. So I think in most cases, it's helpful to everyone to have a chance to develop a full record.
All right, well, going back to what I was about to ask you, you, if I understand it correctly, you're complaining that the board heard a lot about what went into the prior rule, the California rule and the model rule, but didn't review all the underlying evidence that led to those rules. So if I'm correct, you're saying that any time an agency in Delaware wants to adopt a rule, even if 27 other jurisdictions have had extensive evidentiary hearings and developed a mass of information in support of their adopting the same or a similar rule, that our agency couldn't rely on that. Our agency would have to kind of start over and go through everything piece by piece itself.
No, I wouldn't argue that. The last statement I would disagree with. The rest of it, I do agree with. I think that the agency's burden is to put something into the record for the court to look at and review to determine whether there's an adequate basis. It's not enough to say six other states have the same rule.
Wait a second. That's not all that Mr. Pettengill said, is it? I mean, he didn't just say, here, adopt this because other states did.
He said that they peer-reviewed, and it really isn't peer-reviewed. It's state administrative employees assessing technical studies, and actually there's only one that really tested coatings, and that was the NTS study. I'm sorry, could you say your question?
What I'm concerned about is that you said, that the agency has to review information more than just hearing somebody on their staff say, I looked at it.
Right.
And I was saying, didn't Mr. Pettengill or whatever, didn't he actually do a lot more than that in terms of the evidence he presented to the board?
Well, what he did was he explained that they reviewed what CARB did, mm-hmm. and that they judged it to be very good work, and that it was adequate work, and they want the court to accept that as the evidence. That there, in their opinion, there is evidence supporting the CARB rule. And I think it's very clear under the federal case law, and it's clear in the BP&LB Toulouse case, that that's not enough. I mean, if it were, why would we have judicial review? If an agency can just come in and say, we've looked at the basis for other rules, and it's fine. What is the court, how can the court make a decision based on that? It would be impossible. Their duty would be to find something in the California record, maybe the staff report, and show where in that record there's support for all these different limitations that are going to work hardships on Delawareans. They didn't do that, and they can't do that, because there isn't anything in that record. And if it had been, I submit the court to see it now. I mean, they could have submitted it for the court to review, but it hasn't been submitted. Now, our briefing, we went through the Aberdeen study, which is the only one that was listed in the appendix. We explained in the reply brief all the problems of that study. And basically, they only dealt with a few coatings of 76. I think they looked at 7 or 8 coatings. And for the most part, the limits in the Aberdeen, the DOC limits for those coatings in the Aberdeen study were the same as MTCA's proposal, not the energy or limits. So they haven't really given the court any scientific basis, and that's exactly what the court in DP&L Toulouse suggested today. So we haven't got the underlying scientific evidence. You want to take your word for it, we can't do that. And that makes sense. The reviewed process doesn't add anything. Now, the other problem with the having reliance on California rule, and this has been briefed extensively, but there is it's clear that they did not account for the climatic differences between Delaware and California. And in the exhibit to the reply brief, we cite what Staff Alaska, the organization that did the peer review, says about that. They say very clearly that that's the wrong approach. It says Staff at Alachua stressed the need for all state and local agencies to conduct their own thorough analysis of this model rule to ensure that specific conditions and circumstances of the area are adequately evaluated. Some areas may choose to adopt less stringent DOC limits due to climate conditions. They didn't do that. They said it's California had the same climatic conditions, even though a California witness, their witness, said that the climate, there is no place in California that has this fluctuation in temperature, which stresses coatings, or humidity. They've got hot areas, they've got cold areas, but there's not one where they go back and forth. Further, the same witness said he didn't know whether the harsher climate in Delaware would result in failures under the DOC limits in part. So we've had these really dramatic admissions that go to the
harder case. Mr. Harmon, I recognize that this is an important case, but you wanted to reserve some time for rebuttal?
I do, Your Honor.
Do you want to save it now?
Yes.
My name is Valerie Cassidy, and I represent the Secretary of the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Control. I think that I was getting confused about the standard of review, and I don't know if my thoughts would be helpful to the court here, but I'm going to see if they might. Because we're dealing with the review, the EAB's review of the regulations, and there's a standard set out in the APA for the review of a regulation. And Justice Ridgway's opinion said that that was the appropriate standard of review, and that was the way that I was looking at it. So you have a review, the standard of review that's set out, and you have the person who's supposed to review it set out by Chapter 60.
Well, you mixed apples and oranges in your opening statement, and because the Environmental Review Board is never involved under the Administrative Procedures Act.
Right.
You go directly to the Superior Court. You only get to the Environmental Appeals Board if the review is under Title VII. And under Title VII, it specifically says review of regulations, appeal of regulations in C, and it talks about what the board can do. And then in Title VII, it talks about what the standard of review will be. And it specifically says arbitrary and capricious without a reasonable basis in the record. So there's one self-contained route that involves the Environmental Appeals Board. Now, if you move over to the Administrative Procedures Act, it's a whole different process. It says if you're aggrieved by a regulation, you file an action in the court for declaratory relief. So the Environmental Review Board's not even in the process. And then the standard of review is set forth in the Administrative Procedures Act.
I think the statutes can be read together to the extent that they don't really focus on the General Assembly disenfranchised
the
Environmental
Appeals Board. I agree that that's a reasonable reading. But what it means is you never look at the Administrative Procedures Act. You stay in Title VII. And you use the Title VII standard of review.
And I think that's fair and appropriate. However, the Environmental Appeals Board is itself an administrative agency. And I believe that when it hears the appeal of the regulation, it applies, going with that line of reasoning, the standard set out in Chapter 60. But the review of its decision, since it's an APA administrative agency, should be the standard for case decisions in the APA.
All right, well, I'm sure it's just my difficulty in reading the statute, because Title VII says the standard of review is either going to be as set forth in B or C of Title VII. I don't see how you work the Environmental Appeals Board into the Administrative Procedures Act at all. And if, in fact, the Administrative Procedures Act superseded Title VII, then the appropriate challenge to this regulation would have been directly to the Superior Court and not through the Environmental Appeals Board.
In which case, I feel we're not so timely and the matter would be
moot. Great.
I mean, that's right. Now, what the court is looking to are the lawyers for the litigants to help us decide what the standard of review is going to be. Now, what Mr. Homer did was decide to go in Title VII. He challenged the regulation in the Environmental Appeal Board, and it appears that we should be reviewing it under the Title VII standard. And if that's all correct, then that's a one way to approach the case. But if you have any authority to suggest that the avenue he chose was completely incorrect and that this is only under the Administrative Procedures Act, then the Environmental Appeals Board never would have been involved.
I think that the office has made that argument before and was ruled against. That's not quite the case. And I had trouble making that argument when I didn't raise it before.
Well, you didn't argue that Mr. Homer and his client should never have been before the Environmental Appeals Board.
I have never argued that. In this context, though, I think that once, if you do sidestep your initial question, which begs the question entirely.
That's been done with fatal consequences by litigants in the past, but go ahead.
But because the EAB is an administrative agency and it's that, it is in the county, Administrative Procedures Act agency, that once you review its decision, it is a case decision, and that's the standard that one would use if you were perfectly get to the EAB.
Do you agree with Mr. Homer that it's a distinction without a difference because ultimately the issue is the same and the resolution of the issue would be on the same basis?
Theoretically, it's a distinction without a difference, but in the context of this case, it makes a lot of difference.
What difference
because
does it make?
The standard of review may be the same, but this case may not have a jurisdictional basis, and this case may not be properly before the court if it wasn't.
But you agreed you didn't raise a jurisdictional issue below.
Yes. If it's waived by not raising the jurisdictional issue, then yes, it doesn't necessarily make all the difference in the case.
But wouldn't it be a dramatic departure from our jurisprudence to say that the Environmental Review Board's consideration of a regulation becomes a case decision just because it reviewed it? We have this historic bifurcation between review of regulations and review of case decisions, and somehow you say ipso facto, if the Environmental Review Board considers a regulation, it becomes a case decision.
Well, it applies to the standard for the regulation before it, but the appeal of the decision of the EAB would be the substantial evidence test, which is the standard that has historically and is well settled in Delaware law been applied to decision reviews of administrative agencies. So you get a higher deferential standard before the EAB, but the typical environmental, typical administrative law standard would apply after that fact.
Right, well, we'll sort out the standard of review. Why don't you go ahead with your argument on the merits?
Wait, I'm not too sure. and I apologize for focusing on this so much, but now I'm thoroughly confused because looking at 6008, it makes it pretty clear what the standard of review is when the board is considering the secretary's decision to make a regulation. And that's, for want of a better term, the rational basis kind of test. But then 6009 talks about an appeal from the board's decision and uses the substantial evidence language, which, as you say, is kind of the standard administrative decision review, level of review. However, that, to me, I think is inconsistent with the review that's given to a rulemaking decision as opposed to a case decision. And you seem to have just said that after the secretary makes a rule and the board reviews that rule under a rational basis test, then a court reviews the board's decision under a higher standard, namely substantial evidence. Because its rational basis is lower than substantial evidence, isn't it?
Well, there's also a presumption of validity, I believe, contained in that.
That's in the Administrative Procedures Act.
I had thought that it was in both. That's right.
I right, I guess another way to put it is, do you see the substantial evidence test as being a different standard than rational basis, or is that just a different way of saying the same thing?
The common distinction that can be drawn by greater minds than mine, but I see a substantial equivalent.
Okay.
But you represent this agency, and I think it would be important to your client to have this figured out.
I was still grappling with it this morning at 5 o'clock, and I have made lots of efforts and gone through it, and this was the best that I had to come up with. And I have spent quite a lot of time and effort apologizing and trying to put some into it.
Well, let's put the standard review and all that aside for a moment. After listening to Mr. Homer's argument, can you tell us what was in the record before the Environmental Appeals Board and ultimately before the Superior Court, which was factually based in such a way that the board and the court could determine that there was a sufficient factual basis for the regulation that it should be upheld?
Mr. Nyerati from California testified that surveys of coating, all the coating soil in California in 1998, that 50% of all the coating was methane. He said surveys of all the coating soil in California in 2001 indicated that 60% of the coating would have met the rule. There's no requirement during those years for the coatings to have numbers that low. It's evidence that the quality products were being manufactured and sold without the requirement to have the level that low. There's testimony from Mr. Sarah, who said he actually made paints like that. Now, he said it's not the best quality paint, it's the third and fourth quality paint, but a description from him, from one of them, a 15-year warranty, would stand the effect of driving rainstorms, frigid snow, bitter conditions, blistering sun. He said this product was sold in Delaware.
You understand that Mr. Homer's argument was there wasn't a sufficient record made for a reasonable basis for judicial review. You disagree with that?
I disagree.
Without going into this, you don't, at least for my benefit, you don't need to go into the specifics of the different kinds of paints, but from a judicial review perspective, what was in the record that should satisfy us that there was a substantial enough basis for judicial review that we should be comfortable with the case as it came to us?
Boxes of information showing coatings of the standards. Admissions by their witnesses that these statements they relied on in evaluating the quality are to be relied on, that it was reasonable and natural for the secretary for the EAD to rely on this statement. The CARB survey saying how many compliant coatings are on that list are being sold in California before they need to be sold there. Evidence from Deb Brown indicating that DOT calls what the health effects from ground level ozone. Testimony from Mr. Mazzocchi that this rule is necessary to meet the health quality based standards for ground level ozone. The fact is that the record shows that they have all products here. The board touched a door, kitchen cabinet doors, and saw the quality of coating applied by Mr. Cook. The board took them to their witnesses and couldn't tell them what type of coating they had been using, couldn't tell them the product or the manufacturer, and in some cases the DOC level, and then admitted in some instances that what they did was take their good quality, the highest quality product, lower the DOC level, to see how they could force a failure. And then they submitted that information to the EAB and showed them the signs of failure of products at the DOC level. The board was not persuaded by that kind of evidence.
I understand your position from the briefs. And the board conducted a hearing over 2 days where Mr. Homer had a chance to cross-examine a great many witnesses, and then the board issued a 43-page report concluding that the secretary had established a sufficient basis to promulgate the regulation.
Yes. There were approximately 60 binders if you saw the warning and the evidence showing the data sheet for these products. They are there. They do exist. The surveys from cars, the Pattingill testified extensively to his involvement in the agency group. He's a couple points out that the maintenance category, that was changed after SACL Act. It was changed to the OTC level and changed in Delaware. It was raised because there was concern at the time.
Well, did the board just look at 60 boxes and say, we accept the fact that the 60 boxes contain the information you say it does and that you reviewed it?
Absolutely not. This board demonstrated an understanding of the science behind it.
Well, they read all of them. They weren't admitted into evidence.
They saw them, and they saw the compliant coding list, which was the listing of all the codes.
I'm confused. When you say they saw them, did they see 60 boxes in the back of the room, or did they examine the information inside the boxes?
They saw 60 boxes in the back of the room, and they examined the compliant coding list, which was a distillation of the information that contained in the
sign. So they reviewed a summary of what was contained?
Yes. And they asked questions. If you look at it, rather than accepting wholesale, Dr. Gardner at one point says, were you cherry picking? You know, were you just looking at certain aspects? And they asked, not Dr. Gardner, one of the board members, they asked searching questions. They asked about the study that was submitted about panelization. They said, did you orient the grain of the boards properly to replicate the wooden flooring? He said, no. They said, did you equate the solid content of the materials that you're studying? They said, no. Although they presented evidence, the board was not impressed with the credibility and relevance of that evidence. They said they were presenting a generalization subject to manipulation, that the science didn't back up what they were saying.
But did they ask what county or what region in California replicated the Delaware environment?
They did ask if there was, what the climate was like in California, and Mr. Nyland is on Clark, said that Clark prepared this for the whole state, and that there are lots of areas of different kinds of climate. And Mr. Sarah, one of the town's witnesses, indicated that this product, the driving rain, the frigid temperatures that he described as his product, that meets the limits, he said he saw it here in Delaware.
My question was, did any member of the board ask whether there was an area in California, either a county or a geographical area, which replicated Delaware's climate?
I don't know if they asked that question, but there was...
Is that an important question? Does climate have an effect on paint coatings and quality of air?
Yes. But these rules were reviewed, and these coatings that are being sold in California are also being sold here right now. If they weren't suitable for use in Delaware, they wouldn't be being sold here. So it's not like they're just marketing to California. These same paints and coatings that meet the limits in California are being marketed right here in Delaware.
Then what's your understanding of the objection to the regulation?
Mr. Sarah said, we have good quality paints that we have no intention of stopping selling. And you can't really blame them. When they put in a lot of time and effort and money into products and they have good quality products, you don't want to stop selling them, even if you have good alternative products. So med paint is good paint. Really good paint. And this reduction in emissions that we get from these DOTs is equivalent to three major sources of VOC, three industrial companies. These are major reductions, and the difference between what they propose is critical to maintaining the quality of air that we breathe. And there are some trade-offs. We're not asking not to sell paint. The department is not asking not to sell quality paint. But they're asking to cut back the limits because they negatively affect the health. And that doesn't come from burden. But that's what the Secretary is asking you to try to balance that burden between everyone. And he's already said in the record the reductions that are achieved with the gasoline nozzles at the gas station, less than this reduction. They are going to be putting things on small backup generators. The reductions that we're getting to are imposing some burdens on people, and this really just means you can't buy that particular paint here. It doesn't mean that you can't get this quality product. the record shows lots of evidence of quality products, and they don't say they can't make it. They just say they can't sell some of their products.
Okay, thank you very much.
Years instead of 10 years, and the overall emissions are going to be greater. Unfortunately, the real problem here is Denver is playing a game with EPA. They wanted claim these reductions because California was allowed to claim them, and they haven't made any effort to show that there's actually these codes that work in Delaware, but it's going to exist.
Thank you, Mr. Homer.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.
Please rise.